This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasothi. It's the year end, of course. We're exploring some of the best shows by Dr. Harjit Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in 2015. We're going to kick off with the sport of trekking and hiking. It has gained much popularity amongst many Malaysians. And in the year, Dr. Harjit was joined by Alex Lovart of Asian Trail Explorers. And they gave us the lowdown on what you should be aware of if you indulge in this sport. Dr. Harjit speaks about the impact of this sport on the musculoskeletal system, while Alex shares his thoughts on how the Malaysian jungle is a hostile environment and how the Malaysian culture of being terribly competitive works against us at times. Dr. Harjit, do you see Malaysians doing what Alex does? I mean, love getting lost. We are control freaks. We are very conservative that way. Do you see many people coming to see you with injuries, perhaps, because of trekking and hiking?
There are patients coming in with injuries due to hiking, trail running, and they probably come because they like to challenge themselves. They find no thrill in doing the simpler, conventional kind of exercises and sport, and they move towards these more challenging exercises. The only problem is they probably do not assess themselves well, and they tend to overdo it from the word go, and hence they come and see me early.
Is there a difference between trekking and hiking, Alex? And as I said, we use the words interchangeably. There is a difference.
We indeed use the words trekking, hiking, or some say it has to do with the difficulty level, some say it has to do with the terrain. In fact, it doesn't matter that much. The most important thing is that you really know what you're doing, and unfortunately a lot of people don't know. They don't understand that, and especially Malaysian jungle, is a very hostile environment. It's not just a simple thing. If something happens, you're really, really, really are in trouble, especially if we don't know where you are. So don't underestimate that, yeah. What I noticed lately, and I think that emphasizes the importance of what doctor is saying, is that a lot of people are challenging themselves right now so much, yeah, that it is in fact becoming really irresponsible. Mm-hmm. I see people doing, we started all with a simple day hike, then we went for the longer ones. And I know I play a very important role in these kind of things because I'm started doing 2 days, one night hikes in 1 day. Then we started 3 days, two nights in 1 day. So sometimes we're on the track for 16 to 20 hours in one go. Yeah. So that is challenging and people love these kind of things. But then the ultras came, okay, from 20 kilometers become 40, then 60, then 100, now 160. And that's fine, yeah. But I see that people are doing this every week, and that's not fine anymore, okay? Our body is not designed to do this kind of very strenuous efforts and exercises on such a frequent basis.
So, Dr. Harjit, what would be the impact of something like that? And what drives people to want to do it the way Alex is describing it?
No, I think it's the thrill of being able to do it and the sense of achievement if you achieve the goal or the target that you set for yourself. Now, the only problem is the body takes the brunt of it. So if you start at a very low level of fitness or you have never exercised before and you do something which is manageable but you do it too frequently, or you start immediately at such a high level that your body can't take it, then it's not, I mean, almost every part is going to bear the brunt. The lower back, your knees, your ankles. Surprisingly, people don't think that the upper limbs are going to, but as you hike, you actually use every part of your body and everything bears a brunt. So if you don't take care of yourself, if you don't understand that you need to first understand where you're starting from, and get someone who's experienced to guide you through, and you also need to have your end goal, which should fit in, and the frequency at which you do it, the amount of rest in between, the preparation prior to starting is very, very important, the kind of attire that you use. He's very rightly mentioned that, you know, Asian trails, I mean, or hiking in an Asian terrain, if it's unfamiliar, then it's going to be very hostile. So normally when you start, you get someone to guide you. You do trails which are, you know, very worn out, very, very, very definable, and you work from there.
Mm-hmm. What would be a progressive approach in terms of preparation, Alex?
The thing is that because people love challenges, they don't want to go through that progress.
It's the ego.
Yeah. Which is good for the doctor.
It's not only the ego, it's the Malaysian spirit. Malaysians in general are very competitive when it comes to this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Europe, I mean, we can just hike. It doesn't matter. There's no destination. We just hike and have fun. Yeah. Here, if you don't reach a mountain, if you don't go for a waterfall, what's the use of doing it in the first place? Yeah. So this was a big... Yeah, this was a big surprise to me because I'm the organizer of a voluntary organizer of a hiking group here. We have 6,000 members. Yeah, so what I see is that we get newbies. First hike, Nuang. Nuang is one of the last things you should do. I mean, or at least after 3, 4, 5, 6 months. Yeah? But you don't start with the Nuang. People really think that they can do it, yeah, because they don't have a clue at all what to expect, and they say, come on, let's go for it. And then who's in trouble? They are in trouble, but we as organizers, we are also in trouble because we have to bring them out. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what we did is that now we are using a rating system, A, B, C, D, E. Yeah. A is the easiest one, E is the most difficult one. In every letter, we have a rating from 1 to 10. So that means that A... 9.5 is very close to a B1.
Okay.
So at least people have an idea of what to expect.
From the physical point of view, Dr. Harjit, which parts of the joints are we hammering the most when it comes to hiking or trekking?
I mean, like I mentioned, it's almost every part of your body. But let's just, I'll give you a simple example. A lot of us think, okay, say hiking up something like Bukit Gasing. Oh, okay, that's not too challenging. My back can take it. But, you know, when you move upwards, you're going to be bent forwards, okay? Your center of gravity is just going to be right at the foot. You're trying to keep it close to your feet so that you don't fall over and you actually stress the lower back. And when you are coming down, you arc the other way. So at both ways, you are going to stress your lower back, stress your knees, stress your ankles in ways that it's totally different from just walking on a flat ground or an uneven ground. This, you have an inclination or a declining terrain, which puts more stress. Now, if you have back problems from the beginning and you just hop and go and do these kind of activities, then of course you're going to have bigger problems. And these bigger problems then require bigger treatments and take time to actually recover. So if you look at it, your lower back, your knees, your muscles, the ligaments, they need time to get conditioned. So it's always, the idea is start slow.
That was Dr. Harjit Singh and Alex Lavat speaking to us about trekking and hiking. Coming up, Dr. Harjit speaks to us about the abuse of opioids in pain management as well as muscle loss on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back. It's our Health and Living segment and we're doing a roundup of 2015, the best of Dr. Harjit Singh's shows, consultant orthopedic who sort of has a specialization in sports medicine. Earlier on, we spoke about hiking and trekking, and to move on, we're discussing opioids in pain management, which in a way has been abused, not just in Malaysia, but all over the world. Dr. Harjit, a new report published in the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopaedic Surgeons found that orthopaedic surgeons are prescribing opioids at an alarming rate in the US. Did the findings surprise you?
Actually, it doesn't surprise me because we treat alarming problems. So the rates are fine. But pain is becoming something very important. You now have pain specialists. They only deal with pain. So, you know, they are trained in all the medicinal, the injectables, the nerve blocks, everything related to reduction of pain.
Does that complicate your work, though? There's an overlap in specialty.
No, I'm actually fine. I mean, most of us are very happy if we also have support in dealing with the difficult pain management situations. Like if you have back pain, which regardless of how we are treating you, does not seem to go away. and input from a pain specialist is often welcomed. They then can titrate things better, you know, they spend a lot of time with the patients, the psychological element is removed off, and patients get better, because the key is the patient has to get better. But the use of opioids in orthopedic surgery, it's high, probably higher in the US, because I mean, when I look at the literature there, the rates are much higher than ours. Ours is a hospital base. We tend to use quite a bit of opioids. As the patient gets better, we titrate it down. Yeah, we wean them off and we go on to something which is simpler. And even for things like NSAIDs, we know that we give it for the shortest effective duration and we don't get patients there for long periods of time. If patient becomes dependent or they need it, we still try to talk to them to wean things off. But opioids is an essential medicinal target for us during pain management.
So it is true then that opioids are the most effective medicines for moderate to severe pain, especially when you manage short-term pain after surgery.
I guess they are. Yeah. If you have severe pain, we get it to come down. Because opioids, apart from just blocking the receptors in the brain, okay, to reduce pain, they do give you a bit of a euphoric feeling, and then that's also a part of pain management.
Is addiction to opioids unusual?
Now, there is an element of addiction, but the more synthetic ones have a lower addiction-inducing capacity. If you tell me the synthetic ones like heroin and all, okay, fine, those are designed for other funny reasons. But things like Tramadol and all, they are semi-synthetic or synthetic-based, and the addiction inducing capacity is lesser.
What are opioids actually doing? Are they numbing a certain part of the brain?
Let's look at pain. I hit you on your arm. Okay, there will be a nerve receptor there, and that causes pain. That's the peripheral, the far from the brain part of the sensor. Now, that sense goes up to the brain, and you've got all these receptors which actually pick up and tell the brain, hey, you're in pain. The opioids, they have receptors in the brain and also down. So they actually block those receptors. So the feeling does not go up. And on the other hand, it also stimulates other parts saying that, you know, you don't really have so much of pain and you're okay. But having said that, you don't kill off the pain completely. You reduce the intensity. So the injury is still happening. The body knows that it's still injured, and then you manage it some other way.
I mean, I'm just thinking this is going against evolution. I mean, there was a reason why we experience pain.
I think a lot of things in the modern world are going against evolution.
It is true. Right? You are absolutely correct.
I mean, the way...
But how have we contributed to this?
The goal is to make the patient better. Whether or not we are tweaking with the natural responses of the body, we definitely are, but we have our goal in mind. Our goal is, okay, short term, get them better and then don't disturb them anymore and they go back to natural state. I mean, gone are the days that you have a fractured bone and you're just crawling around. That's part of the natural way. So I think in modern care, pain management is important, and whatever we have goes towards that goal.
What are the adverse effects from continued opioid use?
Okay, now look at it this way. You don't manage pain well, you go into a chronic pain state, and these patients then become dependent on therapy, whether it's physiotherapy, whether it's injectable medications, whether it's oral meds, to reduce that pain state so that they can function. So, I mean, the adverse effects is that if you don't deal with it, you're going to have that. But on the other hand, if you're so mindful about the amount of pain meds and the duration that you give, you will always have patients complaining of chronic pain. Now, if you use a lot of NSAIDs, we are mindful about the effects on the gastrointestinal tract. You know, you may have a bleed, you know, it affects the function of the kidneys or long-term use. Okay, and you also have the effects on the heart and your cardiovascular system. That's for the NSAIDs. Now, the opioids, we know it causes constipation, so often we give our patients something for that, particularly those who are on long-term pain relief, like those who are having advanced malignancies, not so much in orthopedics. But we do know that there are problems and there are ways to deal with it.
How do you assess a patient as they start the recovery process? And how do you know, okay, it's time for me to reduce this dosage and slowly get them off it?
Okay, I'm lucky because I'm an orthopedic surgeon. We deal with simple problems. So you have a patient normally coming with a lot of pain, or after surgery, you know that they're going to have this X amount of pain. Yeah. And you do have targets like, okay, these kind of surgeries, my patients tend to get out of bed after the first day. Now, if they are keeping to your targets comfortably, then you know that, okay, now I've put him on an injectable NSAID, I can change it to an oral meds. And as the swelling and pain goes away over maybe 5 or 10 days, I cut the pain meds completely, giving them only as necessary. Now, as I wean off the meds, I'm mindful to tell the patient that physiotherapy, putting his ice pack if he has a little bit of pain, is important. Because it brings you on to further recovery. So you have to take it at a step at a time. But you also have to individualize. That means you have to know that this is how it's supposed to be. And if it's not, then you manage it as it goes.
Following on from the use of opioids in pain management, what happens if you have to remain inactive for extended periods of time while dealing with injury and pain? In the year, Dr. Hajit also discussed inactivity and its impact on your muscles, how we build bones, and how muscle atrophy is more obvious in the younger people. More importantly, how muscles do not function in isolation, and our biggest fear of fat replacing muscle mass. Is there a difference between muscle mass and muscle strength? The word seems to be used interchangeably. Yeah. I can actually even throw in muscle atrophy in there. I mean, what's the difference?
I think that's a good way to start. Now, the muscle mass is the amount of muscle that you have. Okay, it's the structure that you see. So, you know, you can have a big, huge biceps and that indicates that you have a good mass. But the strength often does not correlate solely on the size of the muscle. You also have to have the neural coordination of the muscle functioning very well, where all the fibers are functioning in a coordinated manner, and that gives you the strength. So a big size muscle is not necessarily the strongest. A muscle which is well built, you know, you have done your weight training well, you may not buff up completely, but you are strong. So that's a measure of strength.
That's interesting.
Strength is the power.
And how do you make sure you have muscle strength as opposed to muscle mass?
Actually, going to depend on the kind of exercises that you do for the part that you want to develop. So, I mean, if you are a runner, you're obviously going to develop your hamstrings and your quadriceps. And you start off with technique training and then you go into very sports-specific strengthening and resistance, and that gives you strength. It may not necessarily give you the bulk. Now, when you do weight training designed solely to attain muscle mass, particularly when you do it for bodybuilding, you know, you get a very nice look and a very big, large body, but not necessarily you'll be as strong as the guy who has strength.
Okay, so when I work out, it doesn't mean that if I carry more weights, I'm necessarily going to be stronger.
You will get stronger, okay, but you do not need to have the bulk developing to indicate that you're strong. So you can build up a muscle strength without it looking much, much bigger.
And of course, there's this talk about how inactivity will impact muscle mass. Are we talking about muscle mass or are we talking about muscle strength here?
I think you're talking about both. Now, we have to understand that inactivity also affects muscles of which have a role in the essential function of the body. Like, you can have atrophy of your chest musculature affecting your breathing. And that's very, very important. You can also lose bulk and strength of your core muscle, the abdomens and the lower back. And that has an effect in all activities that you do, giving rise to back pain. So it is important that keeping optimally active is a part of a healthy lifestyle, and it prevents you from having problems.
The research that's come out says if you're not using your legs for 2 weeks, this is younger people, yeah? You can lose a third of your muscular strength, leaving you on par with a person who's 40 to 50 years of your senior. Now, that's a scary thought.
Yeah, I think it's a scary way of putting it. Now, just like we build bone, you know, I've always said this, you build your bone up to the age of 30, and then there is a gradual decline, and in both sexes, the male and the female. As the female attains menopause, there is a sharp drop. Okay, the issue is about the same for the muscles. You build it up to a particular level, and then you have a steady loss of muscle mass, and that's often replaced by fat. So it's about almost about 5% of what you have after the age of 30. And if you're active, you tend to be able to maintain that. If you're inactive, two scenarios, you're either not exercising or you are injured. And say you've got a cast on the part. I think putting a cast on a part and you removing it after 2 weeks, you actually see that the whole area is thinned out. Because muscle strength and mass and even muscle structure is kept optimal by moving the part and, you know, it being used. So when there is disuse or no use, then you tend to get into an atrophic state.
Why does atrophy happen faster for a younger person as opposed to the older person?
No, I don't think it happens faster, but it's more obvious in a younger person because the older person already has a low baseline. So if he's going to lose, say, 5% of 100, and a younger fella is losing 5% of 300, the effect is much more dramatic. That's the difference.
What contributes towards muscle loss when you're inactive? Just the fact that you're inactive?
Okay. We now understand that the muscle is not... You cannot look at it as just one piece of meat, so to speak. You actually have the nerves running from the brain to the part, and the nerves running from that part away to the brain and other parts. And all of this, they function in concert to have optimum health.
It's an ecosystem.
Okay. Yeah, so if you are not moving, there's no stimulus to the nerve, which then sends back a stimulus to the brain saying that, you know, this part is inactive for some reason. So there's reduction of the impulses to the muscle to keep its structure and tone. So if you're not using it, you're also having a deregulation of the nerve. So it tends to increase the chances of atrophy and weakness.
But there's also literature that shows a significant loss of muscle mass is replaced by fat.
Yeah, okay.
Is now, that a bad thing?
Don't scare people. No, I think that...
I'm an alarmist.
No, the
Why
thing...
Why not?
Okay, the way I look at it is this. You know that you're going to lose your muscle if you are inactive. And if you are inactive over a longer period of time, that muscle is going to be replaced by fat. Once you reach the stage where it's replaced by fat, you can't reverse that. So you can't create muscle from fat. So the idea is that you keep yourself relatively active with a walk, a jog, simple stuff, and you tend to maintain it. Therefore, you only lose this age-related loss in the muscle instead of something more dramatic. But we cannot control the fact that as we get older, we will lose our muscle bulk and strength. And at that stage of life, it is very important because forget about running, jogging, playing hockey, tennis. You require your muscles to also move about, have good balance so you don't fall, don't get stiff, support the joints. So there's a lot of essential function of the muscle, which is for everyday activity and general health. So you have to keep active to maintain that.
Dr. Harjit Singh's top three shows in 2015, going back to trekking and hiking, the abuse of opioids and mitigating muscle loss. He will be back next year with shows on orthopedics and sports medicine. Meanwhile, if you have missed some of the shows in 2015, just listen to the podcast on bfm.my.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.